All right, so this episode just kind of jumps into it. I'm speaking with the CEO of Vendable. His name is Doug. They're building a decentralized identity wallet solution for crypto and blockchain. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Let's get into it. For the people who, listening who aren't too familiar with Vendable, would you mind just giving us, a bit of an explanation or an insight into what you guys are building and why you're sort of building it?
Yeah, so at Vendable, we are building what we call a privacy-preserving unique identity network. So we are able to both prove uniqueness of an individual or an entity in Web3 while preserving their anonymity. So we go beyond just the pseudonymous nature of open networks to provide more protections for users. And we connect all of this to DIDs or decentralized identifiers that access end-to-end encrypted data that's placed in decentralized storage. And so this now becomes sort of a new paradigm, we think, for Web3, where users not only own their assets, they also own their data.
Yeah, and I think this is bringing together a lot of sort of hot topics in the cryptography space and in the cryptocurrency space. The two being decentralized identifiers and also zero knowledge proofs. So these are two of the biggest things we're seeing. We're seeing some zero knowledge proof work already being deployed on rollups, but now also we're seeing it coming to Algorand as well, which is, probably one of the key upgrades, which is enabling you to kind of do what you guys are doing. So what kind of brought you to actually build Vendable? What kind of problems did you see in the industry? And where do you want to take Vendable?
So our goal, we're actually building our systems for everybody who's currently not in DeFi. So if we look at trends, if you look at like other technologies and how they were adopted over time, and then you apply that to where we are at right now with DeFi, what we are seeing is that there are a lot of there you really have two choices. You could either be, in this self-sovereign world where you have a lot of freedom, but there's also risk involved. Whether that's from losing your keys or getting rugs pulled on you, or you're dealing with a lot of people that you don't know, and a lot of that is a trap where we feel like there's a lot of expected gain for not a lot of work, and that leads us into some dangerous places. And then on the other side, we have custodians. And they're saying, we are the safe harbor for your digital assets. And what they are not saying is that if you transfer your assets to us, we actually own your assets. You do not own your assets. You just have a credit with our company. And we can choose at whatever time to honor that or not honor that. And so what we have created is what we call the sovereign system, which sits in between, where you have a lot of freedom because you still own all your data and your assets, but there's protections in place. So the risks are now lowered. And so in order to do that, we had to focus on how do we actually achieve that in the first place? And the only real way that we saw a path to allowing you freedom, but reducing the risk was to bring in identity. So we need to bring in identity, like who you are needs to become part of your Web3 experience, but it needs to be done in such a way that you're not exposed at the same time. So you both need to be able to be unique in Web3, but also have that uniqueness protected from everybody else so that you only share information about yourself that you choose with your friends, your families, the applications you connect with. this led us into kind of the, the three big blocks to adoption. So the first is the fear around losing private keys. And you know, we ran, before bots took over our Twitter poll, it was running about what we thought, which we've got to fix for bots. But before that took over, it showed that about 15% of current users have at some point lost a private key, mm-hmm. and access to some assets. And if I were in, if I got in and I got excited and I got my wallet and then I lost my phone and I never wrote the seed phrase down and I lost this money, I would not come back. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
This is just too risky and it's confusing. And so, the first thing that we needed to tackle was how could we, allow people to recover private keys without giving those private keys to somebody else, because as soon as if you have the keys, you own the asset. Yeah. And so we created a system around our decentralized identifier anchor. So we come in, we have what we call as the unique identity validation check. This creates like your anchor into Web3, and then we begin to spin up accounts on chain around that with zero knowledge circuits and some threshold encryption, so that first off, it links to that main account without telling on chain that this is linked, mm-hmm. and then it provides you the ability to query that account about information about the main identity without giving up that main identity. Mm-hmm. So if I needed to, this bleeds into application. So if I wanted to create an app that was only accessible by people in the UK, our systems would allow you to create this specialized account just to log on for authentication services to that dApp. And that account is the only one that interacts with it. And it can query through zero knowledge proofs to the main account whether or not that country of origin is the UK, mm-hmm. or the country of residence is the UK. But we don't tell you yes or no whether or not, what the actual country is.
Yep.
And so we maintain privacies and you get fair authentication systems. And this breaks another issue, which is number two, which is the pseudonymous nature of open networks. Because, as it stands today, if you send me, one USDC, I now have your public address. Mm-hmm. What I actually have is the state and the activity of all your assets, not just now, but in the past, and I can come back a year from now and see as well. But there's no other payment system that works like this. I don't go to my grocery store and swipe my debit card and they get access to my bank account, right? And what my balance is. And so if we think about everybody else who's currently not in DeFi, they're not going to, they will not want to do this, mm-hmm. right? And so there's privacy preserving mechanisms that have to be in place. And so we have options coming up so that, you can connect into a new application and from your main asset account, you can transfer assets over to connect with that app, but it breaks the connection between your main account and that, mm-hmm. that other asset. So it maintains your privacy. And we think that, there's a broad set of applications where that's at play. And it extends beyond just us, like, as individuals. If you look at companies as well, I think current numbers are like 65% of the Fortune 500 companies are either currently building or in proof of concepts with certain blockchain applications. They are all on permission blockchains.
Yep.
They're on Hyperledger, they're on Quorum, they're on an Ethereum sidechain or some co-chain somewhere. And why is that? It's because of the same reason that we were just speaking about. A company would never risk sending the transaction to a trade partner and exposing their assets or their data to them. It just would never happen. And so without these types of mechanisms in place, where are we headed in the space?
Mm-hmm.
Right? If all of the companies build on permission chains and the mass majority of consumers use those chains, have we actually achieved Web3 ideals?
Mm-hmm.
Or have we simply created a new Web2 with a blockchain database?
Yeah.
Where the companies and the institutions still own all the assets and they've just improved their processes.
Yeah.
So, you know, that is the, you know, what we are trying to say at Vendable is that there is another way where companies and institutions can build on open networks. They can preserve their privacy. They can take advantage of all those processes, but users can truly own that data and they can own the assets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you sign up for an application, you can opt into whatever data attributes that they want to, that they need to operate.
Mm-hmm.
And if I no longer choose to use that application, I revoke access to those data attributes because though they were always encrypted and stored in decentralized storage and tied to my DID. So it was truly my data that I owned.
Yep.
And not that company. And it's not stored in all of these disparate clouds and server systems.
Mm-hmm.
and just ripe for theft and abuse. And I've got one more point, but
go for it.
Yeah, so the other problem that we spotted was around, we knew that identity was a main component, and there's a lot of different working groups and projects working on self-sovereign identity. So we already talked about the issue with self-sovereign in that, you know, there's too much risk involved. And so we've created this sovereign system. The other problem with self-sovereign identities are personas in that, and we tie it into the second thing, which is pseudonymous blockchain, where I could just spin up persona after persona after persona. And what is the truth in that?
Mm-hmm.
Where I can put any credentials on any chain and make claims and statements against this. Who is validating and where is the truth? And so we received a grant from the Algorand Foundation last year to solve this problem. And what came out the other side was a standard structure for validators and for identity producers to ensure that truth is maintained in this identity process. I could have a lot of personas, right? Like if we're moving towards the metaverse, you know, perhaps I need a persona, like my business persona, where I go to my meetings during the week, and maybe I'm a DJ on the weekends, and so I have a different persona, and that's fine, but they're tied to my actual true identity,
mm-hmm.
and so there's an anchor there where we can come back to, because what we have now in Web2 and what we're just creating again in Web3 is the ability for bots and uncertainty of what is true and civil attacks against systems because nobody is certain about what is what. And what separates Vendable as an identity network is that there's only one Doug.
Yeah.
And so I may enter into an application through Vendable and you would never know, I could be completely anonymous, but there is security in knowing that that account for Doug is the only account that he can create in that application. So like if you had a social media dApp with Vendable, you could prove that in this application, each individual that's posting is a unique person. There are no bots, and that they're accountable for what they say, you know, whereas today we can't, there's no accountability, and there's really, it's difficult to tell what is true and what is not.
Yeah, no, I think that the last point is probably, you know, the biggest one. We see a lot on social media. It's like, why is no one talking about this? As all the bot comments spam, you know, I think we do need a strong method of like verification and authentication. And, you know, with Vendable using, say, biometrics, you know, that has to be tied in a sort of one-to-one relationship with the actual owner of said account. Or, you know, even if I did have multiple Twitter accounts, they should all be able to be tied back to my one anchored persona. So, you know, whatever I do or say can be traced back to me. Or if one of my accounts is, you know, being used maliciously, there's someone to be held accountable for that. Because having, you know, pure anonymity on these social media platforms is a big problem, right? We see it... especially with like kids at school, there's a lot to do with bullying, which has picked up a lot more in recent years. And then, you know, things we see every day are, you know, bot spams. You know, you get hundreds of like tags on Twitter for, you know, spam whitelists for, you know, all these different projects. And it is very, very annoying. So, you know, seeing, you know, you guys building something to work towards, it is actually really, you know, promising and interesting. And just to bring it back to one of the other points you mentioned, you know, how, you know, there's kind of two ways of like looking after your keys. One is custodial and one is like non-custodial, right? And another big difference there is flexibility. So when you open up a wallet on, you know, one of these offline wallets or, you know, these non-custodial wallets, you have access to the whole blockchain. You can interact with any dApp that you want. You can send any transaction that you want, you know, nothing is going to protect you to say if it's, you know, if it's a scam or not. Whereas with a lot of these centralized exchanges or just custodial services, they don't give you that flexibility. They don't let you interact with dApps. If they do, they're ones that, you know, that group has actually sponsored. So, you know, if Coinbase sponsored a dApp, you know, through their wallet or through the Coinbase app, you would be only able to interact with those specific applications. So it kind of pigeonholes users. So
we've lost the permissionless aspect of Web3.
And, you know, that was quite the biggest thing. And, you know, the first issue you raised is too much risk. And, you know, I can attest to that. You know, I've lost keys. I've accidentally sent assets to the wrong wallet. Yeah. And then, you know, I'm rummaging through my drawer trying to find the keys to see if it's on my old phone, is it on my new phone. And then you realize, okay, I don't have these keys anymore. So, you know, for a lot of people, it is a big issue. But, you know, at that point, that was sort of my first time experiencing something like that. And that was, you know, after I'd been in the space for, you know, over a year or two. So I was already aware of the risks, and when it happened, it didn't faze me once I realized what I had done. But for someone coming, you know, new into the space, you know, my dad's into crypto, you know, he's in his late 50s, you know, if something like that was to happen and he lost, you know, a significant amount of assets, I wouldn't blame him if he decided to, you know, just walk away from crypto. And, you know, I can imagine there are a lot of people who are going through their Web3 journey alone without having much guidance, which is very scary, especially learning a completely new technology, something which is very far removed from, you know, our whole lives. We've kind of, I would say, pampered through like custodial services, whether that's bank accounts or email accounts, or, you know, there's always ways to recover your information if it gets lost. But then Web3 comes along, and if it's gone, it's gone. And that is a massive paradigm shift that, you know, a lot of people are still getting used to and don't fully understand it.
And the people that are leading the charge, and maybe they don't understand how daunting it is for everyday people to join, because like my wife, for instance, right? She has... I've been talking about this for years and years and years, right? And she still asks me questions like, where's the metaverse?
Yeah.
Right? And if she were to get into this, like that's daunting enough. Like she doesn't even know where to start. And then if you start talking about tools and dApps and drops and it becomes a barrier to entry. And we need systems that look like what we know. And so because I've told this story before. Like I said, I started programming at a very early age. This was before Windows. I love DOS. I love command lines. I love being able to interact just directly with the PC. I mean, part of it was a bit selfish. It felt like there was this little world that I knew about that other people my age didn't know about. And then one day I walked into my physics class, and everybody was in a big huddle around my professor. And I went over to see what it was, and Windows 3.1 had just come out. And it was the first time that our school had gotten a Windows machine. And the look on my classmates' faces when they realized that they could interface with this technology in a really simple way that they couldn't before, because before it was all just, slash file this, that directory. It was life-changing for all of them and my generation, to see that these little boxes could be used for so much more. And we need that in Web3. Like that hasn't happened yet. That light bulb, or that a simple interface where people can feel secure and really clearly see the value there, so that they can get in and begin to interact. It's not there yet. So like that's a core focus for us.
No, I agree. We lack that sort of abstraction of the scary parts to make it a lot easier. When I first started seeing on more of a Web2 thing, when on any website you can, log in with Google or log in with Gmail, right? That was sort of like, okay, hey, now I don't need a separate username and password for every single website. I can just use my Gmail and I can have access to all these apps. What you're creating, I would say, is almost, the same level of impact, where users will, hopefully just become so accustomed to, signing with Vendable. You press the button, it scans your face, and you're in. And this sort of abstraction will make things a lot easier for people to get interacting with Web3, and hopefully, any other dApps that are being built across, I would say, the metaverse in a way which is, safe and accessible, and hopefully not as scary as what we have to deal with right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's enough things to be fearful of or scared of. We shouldn't be, fearful of things that could benefit us, right? Because we know as early adopters that there's value and there's benefit there. But from an outsider's perspective, it's all very confusing and scary. And so, yeah, if we can just smooth those barriers, and with us, that portable, reusable identity across different applications. I think we can do something
Oh, definitely.
of similar magnitude.
So I guess my next question is who is Vendable for? Is it for everyday users, or is it for more enterprise, or who's your kind of target for using Vendable?
We originally built this for enterprise. So constructed for really large enterprise to adopt. The goal was to create an alternative to closed permission networks like Hyperledger, where users own the data. So they have the control over the data and their privacy. But then, you know, financial institutions and corporations can build directly on open networks, because what we've learned from them is that they're really confused as well. They are working on POCs and they have rollouts, but you'll see, like I'll do a proof of concept with a customer on Hyperledger Fabric. But then I've got another chain on Quorum with a supplier, mm-hmm. because that's what they're working on. And nobody is, it's like the early days of railroad when all the railroad companies had their own different gauge of tracks.
Yep.
And so they had different listening. And so trains could all run the same width. We really saw an expanded growth. And so that's where we're at now with Web3. And so we're trying to say, here is one open standard that you all can adopt that will allow you to run the same tracks and scale quickly. But at the same time, it's people first, which is not something that we're used to. It's adopted is hard to say by large corporations, but we at least want to say there is an alternative, because we think, you know, it's not worth doing if it's really, if you just end up with the same result,
mm-hmm.
Then it's wasted energy, right? Why would, if I'm a corporation, why am I going to go through millions of dollars of expense to put this new blockchain system in if I'm really just doing the same thing that I did before? You should just stick with the same, you know, system, or maybe just put a distributed system in place. But if you really want to be transformative and engage your customer, you know, in a new way, then we have an alternative for that.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I think I'm just losing you a little bit. So maybe you can just give it a minute or so. And then hopefully you should be back.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You sound clear.
Okay, I think you're back now for me. Yeah. Okay. So no. Yeah. No. That makes total sense. I mean, I guess the biggest thing about doing it on a public blockchain is the idea that it is, you know, public, because, you know, each corporation will have their own ties, whether that's to Hyperledger, that's to Quorum, to all of these other blockchains where, you know, there might not be an intersection. You know, company A might not be using the same private blockchain as company B, and then that's where you have a mismatch, mm-hmm. and then that's where you try to glue things together using Web2, but that's the system we're trying to, you know, hopefully avoid. So by building something like Vendable on a public blockchain where, you know, these corporations can run their own nodes, build however they want, what they want, you know, in whatever language is available, they can actually run their own POCs and, you know, slowly onboard companies that they work with, whether they want to onboard their employees first or their partner firms. You know, it gives them a lot more flexibility in what they do without having to sit and figure out and say, okay, do our partners use the same technology? Because if they don't, what's the point of us building what we're doing? If we're just sitting here on, you know, Hyperledger all by ourselves while everyone else is off on a different platform, it just makes no sense. So yeah, I mean, we can hope that, you know, enterprise will adopt this, they'll see this technology, and then they will start building their own POCs, and, you know, to the point where it becomes almost commonplace for enterprises. And, you know, I think if a lot of enterprise adopts this, it can probably make a lot of transition from one company to another a lot easier. You know, if I leave one company who already uses, you know, Vendable, and I move to another one that already uses Vendable, you know, perhaps there could be a system there in place to help me get onboarded onto my new job, where, you know, mm-hmm. I don't need to jump through as many hoops, because, you know, every time you change jobs, they ask you for all of your information again, you know, your date of birth, your, you know, your education, your like proof of address or your bank details or whatever. But by using Vendable, if everyone's onboarded onto the same system, it just streamlines that whole process. Yeah. And saves
it becomes as simple as scanning the QR code.
Exactly, yeah. And you know, that saves a lot of time and money, because you know, I can believe that HR spent a lot of hours chasing people about the information, saying, you know, it's out of date, it's not up to date, we're missing this information, that information. But then if it's literally you sign in, you scan your fingerprint, and it uploads the information to, you know, your employer's portal, in a matter of seconds, you're done. You've met, the company has met all of their regulatory requirements, and you can just get going straight away, because sometimes this process does take, you know, days or even weeks to actually complete.
Yeah. And also we move away from data silos as well. Yep. In this paradigm. So it's rather than, you know, now I, you know, I had my data over here with this company, and now I come to this new company. Now they're storing my data, and now my data is stored in two places. What we really need is just, I have my own data.
Yeah.
And it's attributed to me. And so now I'm no longer working for this company. They, whatever records they need to keep, they can keep those few bits. But then when I move over here, it's accessible to them, and it's no longer accessible to them, and it's clean, and it's encrypted, and it's secured by my own, you know, fallback authentication systems.
Yep.
So nobody else can access this without my permission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would definitely just make a life whole lot easier. You know, even you could even see like governments adopting this technology, you know, to help them with things like social services, or, you know, for benefits and food stamps or whatever the system may be.
Or voting.
Voting is especially a big one, because, you know, there's been far too many cases of, you know, fraud happening. And, you know, this is potentially one solution to the problem. Yeah. So moving away from a little bit from the product itself, you're also working on a series of NFTs, I believe, Ibble City.
So every Ibble is kind of like the in of all of our products. So Vendible and Trustable. Mm-hmm. So it's Ibble City. We have, like I said, we have multiple products that we'll release, you know, over time. We want to have an anchor point for each one. And so we've created environments for all of them. And for Trustable, our environment is the city. That city has a cause attached to it, and that's air pollution. Mm-hmm. Because it's one of the leading killers of people in metropolitan areas. And so our NFTs look like a bunch of colored clouds. It's odd, and if you look closely, you can see just a hint of something behind it, mm-hmm. but it's kind of a representation for us as a company, in that if you saw like a PR, you know, press release from us, or something about us over the last few years, you'd probably just say that was a bunch of buzzwords, and you don't know what on earth we're about. And it's not until you sort of go, you know, there's effort that you have to take to go through to really understand who we are. The same thing with our NFT collection. We're launching this so that we can grow a committed core of users across multiple blockchains, because Trustable itself is fully cross-chain. We can protect private keys from any of the major blockchains. We can protect private keys from permission closed blockchains. It doesn't matter. And so in order to build that community that will not just come into testnet, do the few minimums, collect their VIN tokens and move on, we want those that are going to understand us and stay with us long term. And so this is our sort of vehicle to do that. Mm-hmm. And And so they get lots of incentives and rewards for this. There's a little personal profile, unique Ibblers, that's the citizens of Ibble City, that you get. There are discounts, so you can lock in discounts on our early pricing for long term on key protection. There, if you can take these NFTs and merge them, whether it's all of one series, or you can take one from Ethereum and one from Algorand, and you can combine them together to level them up. If you reach a certain point, you can rent them out to others for discounts, which on its own doesn't sound like a whole lot until you understand that our main go-to-market is with partnerships with applications. So you can envision a wallet that we partner with, and when you create a new account or you log in and you have an account value over such amount, there's a pop-up that comes up and says, "Yeah, we see that you have this much. Would you like to protect this key from loss?" And the same with the dApp. You could log into a liquidity pool and it says, "Oh, it can read on chain that this key is not protected and it's over this amount." And so there's revenue share opportunities there. But if they have the ability to discount on top of that, then they can they can have an advantage in the market as we scale. And so that could be potentially lucrative in itself. And Venable as a company, we are operating on a net zero profit model. So we believe that the people that are involved with us, whether it's employees or the community, provide a service to others. And that service creates a profit for the company, and we then return that profit to the people. So there's a, we pay our taxes, and there's an employee profit sharing program, and then everything else goes to a third entity, which is our DAO. So we will essentially ship Bitcoin, Ethereum, Solana, any form of payment that we receive that's profit, we'll transfer to the DAO treasury. And then those who stake Vend can then begin to have governance over that treasury and do new things, whether it's investments or they can take part in initiatives, spinning up new projects or things that they care about, and sort of be their own, separate space that's community driven away from Vendable. So it creates checks and balances, because the DAO also audits Vendable as well. So it helps to maintain stability long term, because from a sustainable background, my main concern is not today. My main concern is 5, 10, 20 years from now. Are we putting structures in place now that will ensure long term success of the project? After the core team's gone, right? What does it look like? Are there systems still in place that protect the people that are using the systems? And are there systems in place that protect the foundation and the company?
Yeah, no, definitely. If having a strong core of, the community who aren't necessarily employees, who, have the best intentions for Vendable going forwards is will be key. They'll act sort of almost as governors to help kind of direct, or give their opinion in places about if they think more should be invested to support this project or that project, to help keep, I guess, the goals of the company and the people aligned. And it does come down to the sort of longevity of the project. And as you said, once the core staff leave, new staff will come in. They will have their own ideals, their own opinions, their own views. And you know, you as you said, you need a sort of self-regulation mechanism to do so, and hopefully that will be the community that you've built through the DAO, through the NFT projects, who all want to see Vendable continue to succeed, because it does come back to benefit them in the long term. I mean, that's all for me. If there's anything else burning that you want to really talk about, feel free. I am all ears. I'm just conscious that we've been talking for a while now.
Really, at the end of the day, anybody that's listening, I just ask that we're like an onion, and you need to start peeling the layers. And I can say that the farther down you go, the more rewarding it is. So, you know, if you have the time, jump in, ask questions, read our materials, start to learn. We would love all the support for Testnet that we can get. Mm-hmm. Because once we open source our solutions in the middle of Testnet, we know there's going to be a lot of competition, and we have to go at a really rapid pace.
Yep.
And so we can't do that without a large body of support.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And Testnet is, a good estimation would be about 4 to 6 weeks.
So we're trying to build the community right now cross chain. Okay. So, you know, best estimates there are 6 to 8 weeks, and then we enter testnet.
Okay.
And then another month of testnet before we open source. And then probably once we open source and we release Mend on mainnet, there'll be another month or so of larger testing where we bring in all the general signups, and then we'll go to mainnet. So looking around mid-December.
Cool. Awesome. That's great. So that's where my recording actually cut off. I'll include all the details for Doug and Vendable in the description of this video or podcast, whatever you're listening to. The links to their socials, check them out. As always, if you're listening, thank you so much. Feel free to reach out to me on any of my social media platforms. You'll find them again below. But yeah, until next week, thank you and goodbye.